Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. This is your co-host, Joe Hagan. I am here today with two people who are in my business. They're both reporters who I have an immense respect for, who have written a book that is just simply unputdownable. I immediately emailed, about halfway through, but it only took me a few hours because I was ripping through it. I emailed James Stewart, the co-author of this book, along with Rachel Abrams, to say that this is an instant classic, okay? Unscripted, the epic battle for a media empire and the Redstone family legacy. Okay, so Sumner Redstone, head of Viacom and CBS. I had read about him. I knew just enough to get the surface of the news about, you know, but you never really could piece together what the deal was. He was having a fight with his daughter, Sherry Redstone, or maybe there was some conflict over the control of this company, and it was coming in dribs and drabs, and finally it's been consolidated into one book called Unscripted, and it is freaking juicy, man. It is like a 19th century novel, or it is like a serialized TV show, and it is, in fact, divided up that way into chapters, you know, seasons and episodes, and it reads like that. It is an incredible page-turner, and it is by, like I said, two extraordinary reporters, and James Stewart is a hero of mine and a legend, author of many books, including Den of Thieves, which was one that I remember reading and loving. Welcome to the program, James Stewart and Rachel Abrams.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here. This book is like a cross. I know I'm raving, okay? But it's like a cross between Succession and White Lotus. It's like subplots within subplots. You got sex, greed, extremely cheesy, scheming, amoral characters just basically all over the place. And, you know, at the center of it is Sumner Redstone. Maybe we could just start by establishing the profile of the main character here. Sumner Redstone, this sort of like storied media mogul, very brilliant man with like as many brilliant kind of powerful guys as got all kinds of troubling behaviors and tastes. But maybe you could just tell me when this book begins, where are we with this, with Sumner Redstone?
You know, the arc of the story really begins when Sumner Redstone's daughter, Sherry Redstone, who was trying to some extent to detach herself both from the family drama and the corporate intrigues of her father, was forced into the business by her father's increasingly erratic behavior. I mean, as you say, he created this incredible media empire. He snapped up things that nobody thought he'd ever get. He started out running drive-in movie theaters. He built it into a theater chain. He bought CBS. He bought the Paramount Movie Studio, which was kind of the crown jewel of his acquisitions. He had all these cable channels. He was a brilliant man, but late in life, you know, he kind of descended on Hollywood when he was 76 years old. But many people would be kind of stepping out of the limelight. No, he was just getting started. And it was almost like after years of working constantly and putting all this together, he indulged himself in women, in his interests, and at the same time, his physical health and his mental state were deteriorating. So when the story really opens, he's living in his mansion with two live-in companions. I guess that's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
Who are scheming to take control.
That's right. And just to give people a sense of like what this might look like, you describe his, maybe this is his bedroom or just his living quarters, but he's got like a stock ticker over his bed.
Yeah, he's got a stock ticker over his bed. And also one thing that Sumner Redstone was very famous for, particularly among media reporters that ended up visiting him at his mansion, was a giant fish tank. He was known for being a real active fish connoisseur at his home. So these are two sort of notable descriptions from inside the mansion that are kind of legendary.
Yeah. And he's surrounded by, like, you know, nurses and aides, and he's got lawyers coming and going. And as a part of his sort of late life lust adventure, he's like this sort of like rutting goat who has like all these various women brought in. And you know, and two of them, Manuela Herzer and Sidney Holland, both at one time or another seem to be dates of his in some way. But they end up becoming kind of quasi caretakers and really, I mean, I don't know. Let's just say alleged, you know, they put all kinds of legal caveats on it, but they seem like grifters basically. And they've come in to like take control of his life and download his millions. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair characterization. I mean, let's be, you know, honest here that this is a, shall we call it a career path that has, you know, has been,
yeah,
been throughout history. This is a Hollywood version, but the idea of, you know, highly attractive women latching on to an aging rich man is not exactly a new story, but it's true. At one point, Sumner claimed to be in love with Manuela Herzer. He proposed marriage to her and she turned him down, although she later said that was the biggest mistake of her life. Then through a matchmaking service, he met Sidney Holland and they had a whirlwind courtship. She's soon wearing this 9-carat diamond ring and she moved into the mansion. And then somewhat bizarrely, Manuela was renovating her house, paid for by Sumner, needless to say. And while the renovation was going on, she moved in too and just kind of stayed. And there they were, Sumner surrounded by, of course, the staff that you're talking about, all of whom were witnesses to what was going on. And then just not one, but two live-in companions.
And during the time this is happening, his private life is making headlines. These are but not the kind of headlines that end up in the Wall Street Journal. He's making headlines that end up in Page Six. And it's becoming an increasing distraction. And people around him, including his daughter, are becoming increasingly nervous that his private life is having an increasing influence over, you know, his ability to govern. And there are, you start seeing basically these stories about his sexual escapades. And it starts to become an increasing distraction, basically, for anybody that cares about, you know, the company's stock price. So that's also happening in the background.
Yeah. Well, that's what's beautiful about this book is it's sort of poised between, you know, things you'd read in the vaunted Wall Street Journal and things you'd read in Page Six. And it kind of ties them together in a way that makes it understandable because, you know, these corporate intrigues are all human stories at the end of the day. You know, you can talk about money and valuation and prices and strategies, but at the end of the day, you're dealing with these, you know, Sumner Redstone, this French CEO that he's got loyalty to for reasons that are increasingly not comprehensible. And then he's also being advised by, you know, all kinds of people that shouldn't be advising multi-billion dollar corporations, including these two women, right? So, you know, you guys both were reporting on this for the New York Times, right? But from different angles. Is that correct? And that's how the genesis of doing this book?
Yeah, basically, you know, Jim had been working on a story that involved Les Moonves, basically some of the behind-the-scenes boardroom action that had led to his exit from CBS. And at the same time, I had gotten a tip from somebody that was in a really good position to know about what those boardroom discussions were. And an editor at the time suggested that, you know, at some point I talked to Jim and I walked by his desk one day. I was actually heading out and he was still there. And I stopped by and I thought, well, now's as good a time as ever. And we both realized that we were working on this Les Moonves stuff from different angles and we had very complementary sources. And so it just kind of took off from there. And very quickly we realized that we were going to have access to, you know, between the two of us, a treasure trove of text messages and emails and confidential documents. And those led to a couple really great stories in the Times. And we realized pretty quickly that those stories really didn't capture everything, that there really was a book here. So that's kind of how all this came together.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Yeah, well, like I said at the top, there's like those of us on the outside of all this, we're seeing these stories in dribs and drabs and not completely being able to put it all together and see what the context was. And now that I've read it, I understand why. It's like Byzantine, right?
You know, Joe, we kind of backed into some of the most interesting parts of the story because, as Rachel pointed out, we were focusing on the boardroom drama, the ouster of Moonves, what we called the sort of collision of the Me Too movement with the corporate boardroom, which all of which is incredibly fascinating. But what I didn't realize at the time is that we had to back up from all of that to the point I mentioned before where, you know, Sherry was forced into the bizarre situation in the mansion. And that was partly because in addition to all this other stuff we got, we were able to gain access to affidavits, testimony, transcripts from the staff and the nurses of the mansion, which gave an incredible window into what was going on there. So it was only later that I kind of recognized the bigger arc of the story. And I'm so happy you said there's kind of like a novel because it is nonfiction, but I don't think we'll ever have is the evidence and the reporting and the material to weave a novelistic story the way we were able to do with this one.
Yeah, as I was reading it as a reporter, I was just like, where did all this come from? I mean, these text messages between one of the two women, Sydney Holland, and her other boyfriend on the side who lives in Arizona, right? It's incredible. And by the way, these people are just really horrid. And, she's downloading all this money from Sumner and using it to kind of sponsor her boyfriend, you know, fiance on the side and a lifestyle in Arizona. He knows nothing about it. And they buy a giant black crystal of some kind. Can you describe what this was about?
Oh, my God. What was it? Was it tourmaline? Was it onyx? It was basically something that a Malibu psychic had told Sydney Holland to buy a lot of. And in fact, when I ended up spending a very memorable Memorial Day weekend with George Pilgrim, and he still had a lot of these stones, and he showed me. And I think he had to, like, arrange them under his bed in some way. But yes, a lot of characters in our book seem to be influenced by otherworldly influences, let's just say.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had to put the black crystals placed under the bed were supposed to increase his quote-unquote sexual potency.
Right. Yes.
Which doesn't really seem to have been in question.
Unbelievable. Well, the funny thing about it is this guy, the boyfriend, George Pilgrim, so he had his own kind of weird prehistory before he arrives into the narrative, which I think the whole book opens with him maybe. And he's sort of like got a criminal past. He's sort of like a handsome actor who doesn't really amount to much. And he kind of backs into this whole thing. Maybe because he's got access to a laptop. It gets pretty deep.
He is a reporter's dream source because, any of the journalists listening can really appreciate this. He was shameless, you know? He just said anything that was on his mind. Yeah. And that's the most perfect person to talk to because they answer all your questions. We were mindful that this man had gone to prison for fraud. But he endeavored to answer them honestly as far as we could tell. I mean, we were really careful about backing up everything that he said. You know, there were often people who could attest to what he was saying because they'd been there contemporaneously. But also, as you mentioned, he had a computer full of files, text messages, pictures, emails. He had so much stuff to corroborate his story that it was really a dream. we didn't intend, and Jim has a good story about this, we did not intend for him to take over the beginning of the book, but Jim, do you want to explain how we decided to do that?
Well, first I want to give Rachel credit. She makes it sound so easy, like you just show up and George tells you everything. No, other people had spoken to George, but somehow, you know, Rachel went out there, she spent a whole Memorial Day weekend, and then she extended her stay, and George just, you know, thanks, I think, to her, he handed over this unbelievable, I mean, it wasn't just his memory, it was his texts, all of his emails, photographs. So all this incredible information was rolling back, and, you know, our deadline was somewhere off in the distance. I'd actually started writing, and we started it in a completely different place. And I was starting to, like, in my own mind, get a little bit annoyed. I was saying to myself, you know, this guy George is taking over the story. And I was kind of annoyed because it didn't fit into my little prearranged plan. And then one day I woke up and said, wait a minute, let George take over the story. There's a reason he's taking over the story. He set the whole plot in motion. So I threw out about 100 pages and I started all over.
Wow. Wow. Well, that was a big decision, but it turned out to be a good one. And I will just say that, as an aside, the way the book is written is it's very tightly plotted and tightly written, and it really pulls you in and takes you on the trip. And, one of the fears when you're a layman who doesn't want to read too much about the business side of it is you're very tight with the business stuff and you explain it very clearly and you kind of like are able to get through and stay on the human story. Right. And it really turns out to be that way. It's like even the board members are like these, you know, they're either old friends of Sumner's or people he can control, because really the board is all at his behest. Right. He's the all powerful Oz in this whole thing. And meanwhile, his awareness and his ability to communicate is like a flickering thing towards the end. Right. Sometimes people will come in and say, this guy's out of it and totally a vegetable. Next day, somebody will come in and he'll be able to call his ex-girlfriend a quote-unquote fucking bitch, right? In a deposition, right? The different fiefdoms he's got here are Viacom and CBS, right? And what's the name of the CEO of Viacom?
Philippe Daumont.
Yes. So he was
originally French, and so and he used the French pronunciation.
Right. And he's sort of got Sumner wrapped around his finger for reasons. So Sumner trusts him, right, to run the ship for him. And on the other side, you got Moonves running CBS. And the second half of the book really takes you into the cascade of the Me Too movement and the origins of it. And Rachel, you were sort of there for some of the origins of this reporting and into Moonves's, you know, role in all of this. And it sort of begins with this actress, Ileana Douglas, who we know. Is she the first person that we learn about in terms of accusing Moonves of having sexual misconduct in the past?
Well, I think what happened first, Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, but what happens is that the New Yorker comes out with two stories at different points in time. And one of them, I think they each have six women accusing Moonves of sexual harassment. And I can't remember who chronologically comes first. But basically what was happening is that Moonves has been kicked out of CBS, and CBS has to figure out, can we fire this guy for cause, basically. And what Jim and I ended up learning is that you know, everybody might have thought that the New Yorker was the reason, you know, that Moonves is just the next guy to have a public shaming and get kicked out of a company. And Jim was the first person to get wind of the fact that, no, it actually wasn't as much the New Yorker stories. It turns out that there was this kind of Z-list manager that no one's ever heard of named Marv Dower, who had a client that he was leveraging against Moonves, because basically he remembered that many, many years ago he had an actress named Bobby Phillips who had a meeting with Moonves and had a horrible experience. And then Harvey Weinstein breaks and all this cascade of Me Too stories starts. And this guy Marv realizes that maybe he can get something out of Moonves by pretending to Moonves that this woman's about to come forward and, you know, let's keep her happy. Let's keep her quiet. And so Jim, this is when Jim and I start pairing up, because Jim has heard pieces of this and I start getting information about this. And so what we uncovered partially in the New York Times, but in a much fuller way in our book, is that it's actually Moonves' attempt to keep this woman silent and his efforts to cover up those attempts that really sealed his fate at CBS.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Marv Dower, I mean, he tries to get some roles for her, right? Or he tries to leverage it by getting her roles. Ew. You know, I mean, as reporters, I know we deal with, like, people, you know, occasionally you deal with unseemly characters. But this, all of these people are unseemly, but they, you know, you keep being surprised by yet another one.
Well, you know, again, one of the incredibly interesting things is that we got all of the text messages and emails between Marv Dower and Les Moonves. I mean, it's an unprecedented real-time look at what was going on as he's, like, squeezing Moonves, who knows the difficult situation. And, you know, it's incredibly amazing. But, you know, again, to go to Rachel's point of what did Moonves is, he testified to the lawyers that he'd only had three or four contacts with Dower. But we got, and they eventually got, 400. They were, like, talking every day.
Yeah, yeah. You guys must have turned to each other occasionally and just said, can you believe this? I mean, how that must have been happening, like, every 10 minutes or something. I mean, I'm always struck by, like, a guy like Les Moonves, who's, like, handsome, glamorous, CEO, richest, you know, one of the richest heads of a network in the history of the business. You know, just how just primitive these people are. You know, just like they have, they're sophisticated on the surface and they have sophisticated tastes, or I don't know if how you want to judge their taste, but they're, you know, when they get into these desperate situations, backed up against the wall and he thinks he's going to get taken down, you know, next thing you know, he's like having 400 text messages with like a fourth-rate agent.
Well, right? Yeah, you know, here's a shocker, or at least it was to me. You know, the world that Sherry Redstone was forced into and stepped into was, even though it wasn't, didn't happen that long ago, was, you know, a throwback to, you know, decades of before the Me Too era, when these moguls and powerful entertainment people do whatever they want. I mean, Moonves had someone on the CBS payroll sitting in the office outside of his, whose part of his job was to administer oral sex to him whenever he wanted it. And he testified about this to the lawyers investigating. I mean, yeah, so I called Rachel. I said, do you believe this? And, you know, and again, we were working on this during the pandemic, and I'm so happy I had a co-author because I didn't have anybody else to talk to. So, you know, Rachel would call me and we'd say, oh my God, this is so unbelievable. I was so happy I had somebody to share a lot. And again, when Rachel was out in Arizona getting all this stuff from George Pilgrim and, you know, calling up, you know, again, it was just, oh my God, my jaw was open.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They could go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
Rachel, you know, as a woman, you know, from the female perspective, like, having to hear about all of this and just, I mean, you must be used to it. Maybe you're hardened to it a little bit, but, like, you know, were you nonetheless, like, continually shocked and appalled by, you know, the depravity of these powerful even not even powerful, some of them men, but, you know.
I should say nothing shocks me anymore, I feel like this book really played to both of our strengths in a way, because, you know, it's not like Jim has not spoken to women who have been victims of sexual misconduct. And it's not like I haven't done corporate investigations before. But I think what we did was we both realized that, like, there were certain people that might be more receptive to Jim, and there were certain people who would be more receptive to me. And that this was inherently, we realized from the very beginning, much like Succession, this is a human story. And the best thing that we could possibly do is just try to relate to people, from wherever they're coming from. So was I shocked and appalled? Not really, because, you know, because fundamentally, these are very human, flawed, three-dimensional characters, and that's what makes them so interesting. You know, I think it would be much less interesting if we were saying, oh, Sumner Redstone, what a monster. Nobody could possibly relate to that. Nobody understands it. But it's much more interesting to see him as an increasingly infirm, philandering person who turns good to his daughter and it turns not good to his daughter. I mean, I don't know. I think we both looked at these people and took them in their entirety and saw how interesting they were, and maybe were a little bit less focused on the more salacious aspects. Although they did make for interesting phone calls.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, do we know what Les Moonves is doing today?
It doesn't seem like he's doing too much very publicly. You know, I can't remember exactly how long after he left CBS. He did set up an LLC somewhere in Los Angeles in an office building. But as far as I haven't really heard of him doing anything publicly, and I think he's sort of keeping a pretty low profile. I mean, we've talked to people who have seen him out at, you know, a memorial service here and there, but I don't think that he is being embraced back in Hollywood or media with, you know, open arms, you know, people offering him to do big projects.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's keeping a low profile, although I've heard from quite a few people in Hollywood that they're still friends with him. And I've had people tell me things like, I don't really know what happened to him and these women, but, you know, he was very good to me early in my career, and I'll never forget that. I mean, he was very well liked, and he did advance the careers of many people. And, you know, many people have told me if he just, you know, kind of keeps his head down a little longer, he'll be back.
I did wonder, after reading about all the vile things that Sumner Redstone did and that Les Moonves did, whether these people are redeemable. You know, would anybody ever have Les Moonves over for dinner ever again? Can he re-enter polite society? What do you guys think?
I don't think that we're quite far enough away from Harvey Weinstein to see the redemption of some of these people yet. You know, it's a really interesting question. And I feel like it's actually two questions. One is it possible? And the next one is, do they deserve it? And I feel like, is it possible? That one, I think, is an easier question to answer, because with time and space, many scandals are forgotten. And I think you just see that play out over and over again in Hollywood. You know, everybody loves a redemption story, right? And maybe it's not possible for Weinstein, but maybe it's possible for some of these other people where, as Jim said, they've got friends who think, well, I don't really know what happened. Or, you know, like, give it enough time and space, and are those people going to be in a position where they think, okay, I can offer this guy a movie deal and it's not going to come back to bite me? That seems likely to happen with some of these characters that have been really felled by the Me Too movement. But it's not... I don't think there's been enough time and distance to answer that yet.
Yeah.
And I will say on behalf of Les Moonves, I know it upsets him. I've heard from many people close to him to be compared to Harvey Weinstein. And while his misconduct is pretty severe, he stressed the point that it all happened before he married Julie Chen. And she is very well liked and has staunchly stood behind him. And so I think that is going to play a significant role in if he ever does, you know, make a comeback.
Yeah, yeah. Your book, in a way, it's about all these specific characters, but it also is about the passage, a generational passage or arrival of these old school, thorny old school characters into this modern age. Right. And they're blowing up they're getting blown up all over the place because these behaviors are no longer acceptable. And it's a little bit kind of a dramatic explosion when these guys think that they're still living in the old world, right? And
yes, I was just going to say that I was just going to agree with you and say that this book is really the collision of the Me Too movement and corporate governance. And you really see in real time, because of all the reporting that we were able to do, all the text messages, the private documents, all of this stuff. I don't think that either Jim or I could think of another example where you get to see how a company run by people from a different era is responding to a crisis in real time. And it's a crisis that's very much of our time. It's the Me Too movement. It's Black Lives Matter. It's how corporations are struggling to respond to consumers in a way that's meaningful. And it's being run by people who did not grow up with that. And because of all the documentation we were able to get, we were able to see sort of the real life panic, which you just really don't get in a narrative nonfiction business book very often. So, you know, that's one of the reasons we're so excited to come on and talk to you about it.
Yeah, well, I there was a lot of moments where I was like, in my mind, thinking about some of these people, I was like, stop texting. Stop texting. You are old and dumb. Why are you doing this?
That's a good point. I was surprised that some of them of their generation were so quick to turn to texting. Yeah, but I just second what Rachel said. You know, again, the generational gap and the gender gap is not, it's the executives, it's the board members, it's the outside lawyers investigating them. And then you do see in the book towards the end, more women are coming on the scene, the board's becoming somewhat more diverse. It's probably too soon to know how big of an impact that's going to have, but can only get better.
Right. Yeah. Well, one thing that really struck me, a little detail that really cued me into like how dramatic of a gap there was between the Sumner Redstone state of mind and the state of mind of the rest of the world that was coming into being at that time, was that part of their interest in dating all these women, like sometimes a third their age, and then flaunting them around at different public events. He's trying to impress, and you name them, Larry King and Robert Evans. And I just had to laugh out loud at that moment. It was like, that's what Sumner Redstone, he's like trying to like, you know, make his buddies jealous or whatever, or like let them know that he's as virile, you know. And they're all guys that could, you know, plausibly be in a retirement home somewhere. And in fact, he ends up being more or less retired in his own retirement home with nurses, and he's, you know, getting fed through a tube, right? And yet still trying to control an empire. It's just, it's remarkable.
Well, you know, that's a good point, Joe, because it did strike me as well that in that circle of Hollywood power, the media world, who knows what was really going on? Well, actually, we do in some cases know what was going on. But the perception that you had these beautiful women at your beck and call and were having this active sex life was more important than the reality. It was about establishing your bona fides and, as you say, impressing your fellow aging moguls.
That's right. Well, that goes back to my other point about how primitive this whole thing is. You know, at the end of the day, these guys are like, you know, fancy knuckle-dragging cavemen who are trying to get all the money and the power. I mean, it tells you something about like how, I mean, the takeaway from the book for me was like, wow, money and power turns people into awful, very weird creatures, right? It can really twist you up. It really is when we talked about the 19th century novel, it kind of also is a illustration of the kind of way that money and power and greed twists one's soul and, you know, turns people into degrades them and dehumanizes them.
Yeah, you know, another point that a small detail that I think emerges is how money cures almost any issue. Again, you mentioned, you know, Sidney Hall and Manuela Hertzer and everything they did. I mean, they were sued by the Redstones for elder abuse, and yet they have so much money. They walked away with at least $150 million between the two of them. And now they're on the boards of museums, of charities, and their bios all say, oh, they're world-renowned philanthropists. I mean, really? You know, it just all gets kind of swept under the rug. And these prestigious institutions, they're only too happy to take their money and close their eyes to what happened before.
Well, it's interesting because your book's called Unscripted, and it's sort of playing on the idea that, well, obviously they're in the entertainment business and you couldn't script this. But yet it's almost as if Sumner Redstone financed a live action soap opera of his own, right? And everybody, it was all money, right? It was everybody's getting a piece of the money and acting badly. And it's just the money finances the poor behavior.
Everybody in this book is out for themselves. Everybody in this book wants something from somebody else. Everybody's just willing. Everyone is willing to throw somebody else under the bus to get what they want. And I think that sometimes people think of business books as being about, as you said, the stock price or the corporate governance, or people think of business books as perhaps being about business and money and stock price and all those things. But really, business often comes down to people and their greed and their ambition and what they're willing to do for it. And this book really illustrates that, not just within the boardroom, but also within the home, which, you know, this is a story about a family. I think that's one of the reasons people are so drawn to Succession. And I certainly believe it's one of the reasons people are going to be drawn to this story.
Well, the book is called Unscripted, The Epic Battle for a Media Empire and the Redstone Family Legacy. I couldn't put it down. I love it. It's so juicy. It's so well done. It's a stone-cold classic. It's written by James Stewart and Rachel Abrams, who are like the best of the best. And I'm grateful that you guys came on to Inside the Hive to talk about it. And I'm sure it's going to hit the bestseller list any second now, so congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe. Pleasure.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, "Oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside."
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.